welcome this sunny Juneau afternoon to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Today is March 24th, 2015, a Tuesday. And with me this afternoon is Vice Chair Senator Giesel and Senator Ellis. Welcome. We are expecting Senator Stevens and I think Senator Meyer shortly. I want to also thank Carrie and Jessica, who are helping us as the recording secretary and LIO operator. Without them, these meetings would not be possible. It is 1:30, and I'm calling the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. We have one bill on today's agenda. It's Senate Bill 86, and the sponsor is here, Senator Machicki. Please come forward and welcome with your staff. This is the refined fuel surcharge and motor fuel tax legislation, and we will be hearing the bill today. It's the first hearing. We will have the bill sponsor present the legislation. We have members from the administration here to testify and also answer questions. Thank you for being here. And then we'll take public testimony and set this bill aside. It's my understanding there are a few technical changes we know about already, and so we will be hearing this bill perhaps later this week, and certainly not, you know, we won't be waiting very long. So with that, Senator Machicki, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Costello and committee members. Many of the bills we hear sometimes are a solution waiting for a problem. This is a real problem, and the problem is the short funding of our SPAR fund, Spill Prevention and Response. The Oil and Hazardous Substance Release Prevention and Response Fund was created to provide a reliable source of funding for DEC activities related to oil spill response and prevention. You know, I think DEC was created in 1971, and the first response fund was in 76, but it wasn't until the Exxon Valdez spill that Alaskans were somewhat enraged that we were not in a better position to respond to oil spills with a reserve account, if you will. That is the SPAR fund, and it was financed with a 5 cent per barrel surcharge on oil produced. Decreasing oil production through the years has left us with a shortfall, if you will. So why did we go about this solution? A variety of industries and individuals spill oil and hazardous substances, including private homeowners, mines, fuel shippers, boat owners, and village tank farms in the aviation industry, to name a few. The majority of the spills the state responds to are refined fuels. For example, in FY 2014, of the 2028 spills reported, 1,525 were refined fuel spills. According to Kristen Ryan, who is with us today, about 75% to 80% of active contaminated sites in Alaska are also the result of refined fuel spills. The bill distributes prevention and response costs across all users of refined fuel that are causing these response and cleanup efforts. Essentially, it's a user fee, in our view. The bill proposes a surcharge of 0.8 cents per gallon. So if you remember when you buy a fuel and it says $3.99, it's 0.8 of that 0.9. It's a relatively small amount. The reason we went for 0.8 cents is we calculated the likely exemptions, and we think it adequately funds the SPAR fund. We're certainly asking the department to be as efficient as possible with those funds. If someday it has to be adjusted up or the per barrel fee needs to be adjusted up, that's something we can look at. But this 0.8 cents adequately funds the fund.
And so, we've been welcomed by or joined by Senator Meyer.
Thank you.
Welcome.
So there's a couple of things to consider with this bill. First of all, we have a shortage of $800,000. What brought it to my attention is when we began looking at the capital budget this year, and the governor had a couple of reapprops that he directed to cover this shortfall in FY15 of $800,000. So we're putting intent language in the budget to cover the FY15 by allowing a one-time switch between funds, and then it'll start also picking up the shortfall in the future. With that, Madam Chair, if you would like a sectional, my staff here, Larry Simmons, is certainly equipped to provide that for you.
Thank you, and I would like a sectional review for the committee members.
Oh, yes, of course.
Thank
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Larry Simmons. You have in your packet a sectional that was written by Legislative Council. I'll just go through that, and then if there's questions, we'll address those. So, Section 1 amends AS 4305230G by adding qualified dealer license information to the list of license information that's public. Section 2 adds a new surcharge, a refined fuel surcharge, to AS 4340, lists exemptions to the surcharge, and states that the legislature may appropriate the balance of the surcharge to the oil and hazardous substance release prevention account of the oil and hazardous substance release prevention and response fund. Section 3 amends 4340.010A, the motor fuel tax, to conform to the addition of the refined fuel surcharge in Section 2. Section 4 is also conforming. Section 5 amends 4340.010E to specify that 4340.010E applies only to the motor fuel tax and not to the refined fuel surcharge. And, Madam Chair, that is probably where one of the technical amendments will come in later. Section 6 replaces repealed 4340.010C that applied only to the motor fuel tax with a new statutory section, AS 4340.013, that sets the schedule for remittance of the refined fuel surcharge and the motor fuel tax and allows a deduction from the amount owed for the expense of filing a return. Section 7 amends 4340.015C to specify that the certificate of use requirement in 4340.015 applies only to the motor fuel tax. And the next two also are similar, just specifying that these only apply to the motor fuel tax. Section 10 amends AS 4340.035A relating to refunds for resales to include the new refined fuel surcharge. Section 11 amends 4340.035C relating to federal fuel purchase with a credit card to include the new refined fuel surcharge. And Section 12, again, is just adding so that that section includes the fuel surcharge. Section 13, similar. Section 14 amends 4340.070 related to the refund of motor fuel tax from the highway fuel tax account to clarify that 4340.070 only applies to the motor fuel tax. Section 15 adds a new subsection to AS 4340.070 requiring that the department refund the refined fuel surcharge from the oil and hazardous substance release prevention account of the oil and hazardous substance release prevention and response fund. Section 16 amends AS 4340.080A relating to determining the validity of a refund claim to include the new refined fuel surcharge. Section 17 amends 4340.085, requiring dealers and users of fuel to maintain records related to sales of fuel for 3 years to include the new refined fuel surcharge. Section 18 amends 4340.092A, relating to a motor fuel exemption for certain jet fuels, to specify that the subsection applies only to motor fuel tax. Section 19 adds a new section, AS 4340.094, creating a qualified dealer license in statute. Section 20 amends the definition of dealer, AS 4340.101, to include the new refined fuel surcharge. Section 21 amends the definition of qualified dealer to include the new refined fuel surcharge. Section 22 amends the definition of user to include the new refined fuel surcharge. Section 23 adds a definition for refined fuel. Section 24 repeals 4340.010C. Section 25 provides transition language for regulations related to qualified dealer licenses. Section 26 provides an effective date of July 1, 2015.
Thank you, Larry. Appreciate that. Are there any questions from committee members? Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if this question is better for the administration, then just say so. And you may have explained this, and I got here late. My apologies. So we know production is going down. So should we just do a penny so we don't have to come back and deal with this again in 2 or 3 years?
Well, I can answer that, if I may, Madam Chair, through the Chair. We could have done a penny, Senator Meyer. We believe the funding is adequate at 0.8 cents, even taking the exemptions that will likely occur into account. It's more than adequate funding at this time. We're hopeful that production increases. And if it doesn't, we believe that we have a couple years, and if we have to adjust that number up, we can. But we don't believe in providing more than adequate funding for the program.
Okay. And Madam Chair, if I can continue.
Please, yeah, please continue.
I guess my thought is if we're going to implement this new tax, and that's essentially what it is, you know, I'd prefer to only have to do it once and not have to, you know, look at it again 3 or 4 years from now. And, you know, if there is surplus money, then maybe that could be used to maintain our roads that the vehicles, you know, drive on. And I don't know if you thought about that. And then the other question I had was, I think you said 75% of the spills are refined fuel spills, or last year there was 1,525 were refined fuel spills out of the 2,000 spills. What other type of spills are there other than the refined spills?
Through the Chair.
Senator Michiki.
Senator Meyer, there are many different kinds of spills. There are, you know, dry cleaning solution, there are batteries, there are different types of
antifreeze, perhaps?
Spills, sure, glycol. Mm-hmm. And to answer your other question, my bill is about providing a solution to the short funding of SPAR. It's a surcharge. If someone else is interested in requesting a tax for other reasons to do with transportation, that's not what this bill's about. So this is about just adequately funding the SPAR fund.
Okay, Madam Chair, if I can continue.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you. And thank you, Senator Michiki. One more question. You know, I've always been a believer that the cost causer should be the cost payer. And apparently those who are creating the spills, either we're not collecting from them or we're not collecting enough or we don't know who are doing it. What's your suspicion?
Well, there are various situations through the Chair. Senator Meyer, in many cases, the department certainly has the laws on the books that they're required to go after spillers, and some of the smaller spills where folks may not have the ability to pay is where this fund is most useful. But I know I just heard of a recent spill on the Dalton Highway where they don't know who did the spill. Or if you think about a mom-and-pop gas station that closed down years ago, and those folks may no longer be on this earth, and they discover an old source of leaking hydrocarbon storage tanks, there's sometimes no one there responsible for this bill, so SPAR is used for that. And that brings me to another point, if I may, Madam Chair. We originally looked at this and we thought about adding some to the per barrel cost for the producers and a surcharge on refined fuels. And we did a lot of homework on this. As you know, the risk that was available with the industry when OPA 90, the Oil Spill Protection Act of 1990 came about, which is sort of what was the cause of this fund, if you will, or the increase in the funding. That 5 cents per barrel was based on a level of risk in 1990 for the industry. There's been a fairly dramatic reduction of risk for several reasons. One is increased pipe inspection, double hull tankers, enhanced sea plans, and the lower production. Lower production equals lower risk. So at the same time, the companies initiated things like the Prince William Sound RCAC, Cook Inlet RCAC, CERBS, which is the organization that is the response arm of the producers, Alaska Clean Seas, CISPRI. Their investment annually is about $170 million. So for the public that may think we're trying to offset this cost, the industry invests handsomely every year. They've got about $500 million in response assets. One drill alone this year, Senator Meyer, cost $1.8 million for a nearshore drill in Valdez. So they invest handsomely. They're expected to take care of their own spills. They literally are funding all of the other spills. So when I talked about a dry cleaning solution spill that we discover 30 years after the property owners have sold the property, this fund is for those smaller spills where folks either don't have the ability to pay or are long gone.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Senator Meyer.
Yeah, and I know I said, well, that was going to be my last question, but more Senator Michicki talks, more questions I have. You're absolutely right. The industry itself, the oil industry itself, who's paying into the fund now, pretty much take care of their own spills, if there is any. So who are we going after here? Who's causing these spills that we're not collecting enough from? Do we have that data? I see you have the DEC folks behind you. So
And we can bring them up if the chair's wishes, but you know, the vast majority are things like home heating fuel tanks, you know, boat yards, boat storage yards, mines. I talked about dry cleaning solution and those sorts of things that have to be cleaned up years later. So these funds would be used for those cleanups. They're also used in the prevention. What we would like to see the department do is increase the amount of awareness that they provide to those that have simple things like a rigid pipe between the storage tank and the home at grandma's house. The neighbor kid climbs on it one too many times, and 350 gallons of diesel end up on the ground. We'd like to see, you know, flexible stainless tubing and that sort of thing, perhaps helping to instruct boat owners to not top off their tanks in the late fall when it's cold so that they don't expand and spill out of the vents in the spring when they don't get to the boat till May when it's much warmer. Just some of those little things we believe can reduce the need for the spill fund, and as it becomes more efficient, as opposed to increasing that 0.8 cents, Senator Meyer, through the chair, we hope to see a reduction in the need for spill response and prevention in the future.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Senator Michicki, and I want to welcome Senator Stevens to the committee. Welcome. So the Spill Prevention and Response Fund has been underfunded for some time. Have there been previous efforts besides this legislation in the past, and can you explain perhaps why that didn't make it through the process?
Well, my understanding is in the past they specifically went after an increase per barrel charge. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if that's the reason for the resistance. I can't really speak to that, but I would assume that that has something to do with it. And I think folks realize that the folks paying the per barrel charge, and I call it a surcharge because no matter what, it's likely going to trickle down, whether it's at the producer level or at the distributor level. This is at the distributor level, those that now distribute and pay the refined fuel tax are going to use the same system, which is why it doesn't have a fiscal note. So I can't speak for the reason, but I know what brought it to my attention this year is I wanted the reappropriations to go back into the general fund, and I don't believe the state should raise their hand and cover these costs. The state's not causing the spills. Mm-hmm. So I think it should go to the folks that are responsible for those spills.
And the rationale for the bill, could you just expand on that? So the rationale then is that those who are responsible are also contributing to the fund, and that has not happened in the past since the fund's creation in 76?
That's correct. And in this case, we feel that so if you went directly to those at fault, some of them simply don't have the ability to pay, or they're gone, like I said. And they may have transferred the property 25 years ago before a spill source is recognized. So essentially all of us contribute. It may be a filling station that many of us used for many years, but that filling station is long gone and there's no one there to pick up the bill. So this helps us all to contribute. The most perfect user fee would be everyone that spills a drop is responsible for that drop, and that drop could be, you know, 500 gallons, but that's not reality. So it tries to spread the cost fairly across those all of those users that use refined fuels in the state of Alaska.
And when you chose the 0.8%, did you look at the usage of the motor fuel tax in Alaska overall and then basically decide what you wanted the fund to have in it and do the math in that manner? I mean, how did you come up with a 0.8?
We did. At 0.8, we believe this delivers about between $7 and $8 million a year with the exemption of the international flights. We did exempt international flights. We didn't exempt the other typical users, and we're exempting the state purchases of fuel as well.
And that was my next question. Could you go over the exemptions, please?
Thank yes. you. If I can hand it off to my trusty staff here.
Madam Chair, Larry Simmons, for the record, the exemptions are in Section 2 on page 2. So the first one is fuel sold to federal government agency for official use. We're simply precluded from applying the surcharge to that fuel. Similarly, fuel refined and used outside of the United States, this would be, for example, if an aircraft landed at Anchorage International from Japan and flew on to Iceland, that fuel was refined somewhere else and used for somewhere else. It would have broader application, but that's the main thing. Liquefied petroleum gas, fuel sold for use in jet propulsion aircraft operating in flights to foreign countries or that continue from foreign countries. There are international agreements that would make messy litigation, I think. There are some states that have attempted to tax that sort of fuel, and it ends up not great results, so we just felt that it was appropriate to exempt that. And then fuel sold or transferred between qualified dealers so that it's only taxed once, not multiple times.
Thank you. And then in Section 17, where you say in the sectional that it requires dealers and users of fuel to maintain records relating to the sales of fuel for 3 years, can you talk about that? Is this an onerous requirement or not? Is it sort of necessary? And have you heard any feedback at all on this provision?
Yeah, Madam Chair, the reason why we don't have a fiscal note is we worked with the department through a pretty extensive set of meetings, thanks to DEC and Department of Revenue. They're currently filling out those forms. This just adds an extra box for the fuel that we'll be paying the 0.08 cents.
And then one final question before we go to the department and the administration. Have you heard any objection to this legislation, and who did you reach out to while you were working on the bill?
We have not heard any objection to date. We reached out to, do we have letters of support from CIRCAC yet? We have letters on the way from the response organizations. We have spoken to State Chamber. They wanted to learn a little bit more about the bill before they had a comment for or against. Same thing with AOGA. As you know, there's not a lot of time left, so we're trying to get folks to engage as quickly as possible, and this is a relatively late thought for a solution that we'd really like to get through this session.
Okay. Any questions for the sponsor? Senator Stevens?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, a question about the stability of this $7 or $8 million. Do you expect that to be consistent over the next 10 years or so, or do you expect to see an actual decline in that amount of dollars?
Well, it's not a percentage of the fuel price, right? It's per gallon. I think that's a fairly consistent number, but the department might be better suited when they come up to answer that question.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One more quick question. You talked about the exemptions, and the first one was fuel sold to a federal government agency for official use. Is that military, or what would that be?
The military would qualify for that as federal government, but and I can't off the top of my head think of other federal government applications that would receive delivery of a large volume of fuel, maybe at the military bases. DOR, again, the department would perhaps have a better handle on that.
Okay. Well, who came up with these exemptions? Was that you or the department?
It was in cooperation with the department, with our legal drafters.
Okay. I guess I'm just wondering why we are excluding the federal government from this.
Well, what I was told, I'm sorry, I'm not following protocol through the chair, Senator Myers.
I'm not sure.
I was told that we cannot. That we simply cannot tax the federal government, or any fuel delivered to the federal government is not eligible for this surcharge.
And Senator Meyer, we have two representatives from the Division of Tax here, so we might also have them answer. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought I had heard in your remarks that the state would also not have to pay the tax, and yet I don't see them in the exemptions.
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, that's a good observation. We do have a CS plan that would address that issue.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you, Senator Machicki, and your aide, Larry. Really appreciate you coming forward. Next, I'd like to invite Commissioner Hartig and Division Director of the Spill and Prevention Response, Kristen Ryan, forward. Welcome, Commissioner, and Ms. Ryan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Larry Hartig, Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. And I'll be short, then turn it over to Kristen, and then we have Department of Revenue represented here, too, and they can get into the details. But I just wanted to again, thank Senator Machicki and on the House side, Representative Munoz, for coming forward. This is a need that's been around since before I started at DEC 8 years ago. I know I've had discussions with Senator Meyer and others over the years about the need to do something to try to make this fund sustainable, because otherwise what we're going to have to do is cut back drastically on services, and it'd be services to the villages, and when they have spills, we won't be able to go out there like we can now. We won't be able to train people like we can now. It'll be everybody that'll be affected. And so I think it's essential that we get this bill through. The other thing is timing. As Senator Machicki mentioned, we're basically out of time. Even with our budget, now, of course, we had closeout in Senate Finance last night, but it doesn't address the shortfall that we will have next year. You know, there's almost this presumption that we're going to come up with some other way of dealing with that shortfall, and that shortfall is $7 million. There is in your packet, I know, a table that shows the status of the response fund and makes projections for the next 10 years, and you look at the bottom line of that, it's $7 million year after year. That's kind of the critical number. But with that, I again appreciate your interest in the bill and hearing that and spending this time, especially towards the end of the session, on it. But if I can, I would like to turn it over to our SFAR director, Kristen Ryan, and then, Ken, do you want to come up now? And we can, if you'd like, Madam Chair, we could have revenue come up at this point.
Are there any questions for the commissioner? Seeing none, thank you, Commissioner.
Okay, thank you.
For the record, my name is Kristen Ryan, and I'm the director for the Division of Spill Prevention and Response. And I will only just make a few points and be available for questions, as will Director Alper, who can answer some of them as well. I think one issue that's come up I would like to mention is cost recovery and our ability to collect our costs that we've spent working on sites like this, and that sometimes works and it sometimes doesn't. But we're doing everything we can to improve our cost recovery efforts. We've automated our billing system, so now we bill monthly. We used to not do that. It used to be a manual process, and bills were not sent automatically every month. So doing things like that to try to improve our ability to recover the costs. But there are several situations where we are unable to do so. The oil industry, I have to say, though, we do recover all our costs related to oil incidents. Any kind of entity that we regulate or has the responsibility, the financial responsibility, to have an insurance policy to cover our costs so that we can recover them. The issue is the community that we don't regulate. It's the small spills that we don't have that financial responsibility requirement. You can't even get insurance for your home heating oil tank, actually, in the state. And we're working to resolve that. We are working to try to make it so people can get the coverage they need for those situations. But those are the situations that we're trying to address here. And I will leave it at that unless there's questions. Okay.
While we have you in front of us, could you explain the fiscal note since it came from your division?
Yes. It represents a zero fiscal note. We don't see any change in cost to the division to implement this. This is just a revenue stream. So there are Department of Revenue fiscal notes that Ken will speak to, okay. One addressing the revenue that would be generated and one the cost to implement this. So I'll defer to Ken for that.
If I may, then I should put myself on the record first. Madam Chairman, my name is Ken Alper, A-L-P-E-R. I'm the Director of the Tax Division at the Department of Revenue. And I want to apologize for what I think is a logistical oversight. We do have a fiscal note that's primarily the revenue fiscal note. It estimates what the dollar value of what would be generated by this bill would be beginning in FY16 and has several paragraphs of narrative that explains more or less the mechanism by which we came up with that number, what the universe of actual fuels that would be subject to this new surcharge would be. Although that was prepared, and I know it's been received by the companion legislation in the other body, I did not see it on the table here when I got in this afternoon, and I'm curious about that, and we'll find out where that fiscal note is.
Thank you, Mr. Alper. And as you saw, I was just talking to my committee aide about where is the fiscal note, but I appreciate that. And the intention is to have public testimony today, and so we'll have you back, and at that point you can explain the fiscal note. It's always nice to have it in front of us, so that will help the members, I think.
But if I may, Madam Chairman, just to put the number on your head, and the sponsor, Senator Michiki, was correct, the FY16 estimated revenue of the bill as it sits before you today was $7.7 million, with the additional exemption of sales to state entities that might remove another $100,000 or two from the fiscal note, put it more in the 7.5 range once we revise that.
Questions? Senator Meyer.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious, Kristen, how do you handle a spill? Do you send out employees or do you send out contractors to clean up these spills, or how does it work?
Senator Meyer, through the chair, it depends on the event. Every event is a little different. For example, we just learned of one right before this hearing. There's been another truck rollover on the Dalton Highway. So we are sending a responder up there. The trucking company that is responsible for this incident has an insurance policy and already has a contract with a response contractor. So our role here is strictly oversight to ensure that the contractor is doing an adequate job of cleaning up the spill. If it's over a creek, for example, that's a lot more serious situation than if it's over dry land. Or if it's over the pipeline, for example, we have several spills last year that ended up on the right-of-way or the Alyeska pipeline that had to be very careful about how we removed that soil. So every incident's a little bit different, how involved we are. In villages, for example, it depends on the size of the spill. If it's a little one, we have stashes of supplies and connexes throughout the state, and we may just tell them to go the combination to the lock, and they can go get the absorbent material and clean it up and dispose of it correctly. If it's larger, then we'll go out and assess it and decide what next steps have to happen. Sometimes we hire our own contractors to do it. If there's some imminent threat to the environment or human health, and we cannot find a responsible party, we have the authority to take over the cleanup. but that is not our preferred method.
And I appreciate the question, Senator Meyer. Perhaps, Ms. Ryan, you can provide me with the overview that you have given to the Resources Committee, because I think that division overview would help sort of give the history of the fund, because it is the significant change since its incorporation. Senator Meyer?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question is, how many employees do we have dedicated to this function?
Senator Meyer, through the chair, there are approximately 160 employees in the Division of Spill Prevention and Response. They are currently divided primarily into three units, but I'm combining two into one. So it's going to drop down to two main units, and that's going to be one, which is contaminated sites. That's the unit that deals with the long-term contamination that takes sometimes years to resolve. And then the other unit is my emergency response unit. They also are now going to be the planning unit that does all the contingency plans, that works with our regulated companies to be prepared to respond if an event occurs, and they are also the responders. They will be the ones that go out when an event does occur to make sure that the regulated company is doing what they said they would do, and then also dealing with these facilities that aren't regulated and helping them through the process because they don't have that infrastructure in place.
Okay, Madam Chair, I appreciate that, and I appreciate the response. I guess where I was headed here is that these employees that are dedicated to cleaning up the spills, obviously there's not spills going on all the time, so I'm wondering if we would be better off contracting out that service rather than having our own employees who may or may not be busy all the time.
Right. Senator Meyer, through the chair, and we do have contracts. We definitely don't try to respond. We really are trying to rely on the private sector to do that. The majority of the work, this is why actually I'm combining my planning unit with my responding unit, because I want my responders, when they're downtime, I want them to be working on the planning efforts, all the drills and exercises and contingency plans. We've reduced five positions and $500,000 from our budget in the FY16 budget cycle as a reflection of the efficiencies we're going to gain by combining my planning unit with my response unit, so that when we have downtime, we're actually doing other necessary work rather than waiting for an event.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Stevens?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Really the same question revenue. So we're talking about $7 to $8 million annually, and my question was, is that consistent? Can we plan on that the next 10 years? Because it's based on oil production. What kind of projections do you have on oil production? And my question then is, can we expect that amount to decline over time? And is that going to be enough money to do the job we need to have done?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, to clarify, this particular surcharge is not based on on oil production coming from the North Slope, but oil consumption, essentially a wholesale distribution within the state of Alaska that's consumed, whether in cars or home heating oil tanks, that sort of thing. So when you see references in the bill to motor fuel, what we've essentially done is bolted this new language onto the existing Title 4340, which is Alaska's motor fuel excise tax, and created this surcharge that applies not just to the four motor fuels that we currently tax for gasoline, marine fuel, aviation gas, and jet fuel, but creating this, which was intended to apply to a broader spectrum of refined fuels, not just the ones used in motorized vehicles. So when you see the word motor in there, it's supposed to apply to a larger set of all the refined fuel consumed in the state.
Thank you. So the answer I'm getting is that it would be sustained over time at $7 to $8 million.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, we expect a small growth over time, more or less as the underlying economy were to grow. Our fiscal note estimates about a 2% growth per year. We obviously have a long history of collecting motor fuel excise taxes. We can go backwards and then project forwards. Round numbers, the amount of refined fuel on which the taxes are currently paid is a little bit over 600 million gallons per year. There's another almost billion gallons a year on which taxes are not paid due to one or the other existing exemptions in statute. So somewhere in between that 600 million and 1.6 billion is the tax base for this new surcharge, and at 8.8 cents per gallon is, as Senator Machicki said, we sort of reverse engineered the tax rate that would be needed to raise their roughly $7.5 million per year.
Senator Stevens?
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Alper, do you anticipate, can you anticipate the legislature hearing, you know, this legislation again because we're trying to increase it? I mean, is this, in your estimation, is this the last time for a while that we'll see this kind of effort, or do you feel confident that the estimate is will satisfy the need?
Madam Chairman, I might not be the best person to speak to the long-term needs of the SPAR division. You know, our job at the Department of Revenue is to collect and administer the taxes. It is my belief that the fiscal note that unfortunately you don't have before you is correct order of magnitude-wise and will raise the amount of money we believe that it will. Whether that's enough to meet the needs of the SPAR division multiple years from now, I'm not the best person to answer that question.
Ms. Ryan? I think we need, besides two chairs, we need two microphones.
Madam Chairman, as Senator Michiki has stated, our current deficit is approximately $7 million, so this legislation as proposed would generate that. Will we be back in the near future? It's a little bit hard to predict. It depends on oil production because that's the other source of revenue we're relying on. If oil production continues to decline, then perhaps we will. I'm motivated to do whatever I can to reduce our costs so that I can extend the life of this increment as far as we can. So we'll see if we can do some other things to reduce our use of the fund, find other ways to do cost recovery that are more effective. So hopefully we aren't back very soon.
Okay. And we've heard testimony that indicates that this is trying to sort of broaden the those who are paying for the spills, and Mr. Alper mentioned that 100 billion gallons are used in the state from those who are exempt from this tax. And can you just give us a general overview of, you know, do we see the state being responsible for cleanups from that user group, for lack of a better term?
Madam Chairman, yes. I mean the items that are listed in the version that we're looking at, we do have spills and contaminated sites associated with those user groups. The federal government is clearly a spiller of fuel, and we have multiple contaminated sites. We do have federal funds that we use with most of our federal partners. They don't reimburse us for all our costs, but a large percentage. So there are costs there. The state government owns many contaminated sites and causes many spills. So, yes, there are spills there, but I think the bill sponsor and Department of Revenue and DEC work pretty closely together to try to see if I think the only exemptions you see here are the ones that were absolutely necessary by law or for some other really important reason, but I would have to defer to the sponsor to explain.
And then what percent of your budget does this represent, the $7 million? What's your total division budget?
Madam Chairman, my total division budget is around $19 million. $8 million of that is federal funds that come for our oversight of federal contaminated sites. The remainder is the response fund.
Okay.
And then the department uses a portion of the response fund for administrative overhead.
Okay. Any other questions, Senator Meyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Rankin, this may be an unfair question, but I'm, you know, it still bothers me a little bit that we can't tax the federal government, that they can tax the heck out of us. But anyway, that's beside the point. But, you know, I'm trying to think who are some of the bigger polluters in our state, and I can't help but think about these legacy wells up on the North Slope that have been there since the 40s and still aren't cleaned up. Is your group monitoring that, or is that somebody else?
Senator Meyer, through the chair, it is us. We're the ones working with BLM to get resolution on those sites. And thankfully, the federal law does require federal agencies to comply with state law, and that's not always the case. I mean, so they have to meet our cleanup standards, even though it's federal land. So that's a distinction that gives us quite a bit of power. And we try to use it as effectively as possible. For example, the BLM, they are interested in cleaning up many of those sites, but they may not be looking at them at the same way we would look at them. So we're spending quite a bit of time making sure if they go out there that they're actually assessing contamination that maybe you can't see. You know, they're cleaning up the visual aspects of contamination, the drums on the ground or the oil, but they may not be they weren't initially interested in collecting soil samples to see if there was other deeper contamination that needed to be removed, which is going to really increase their costs. But those are the kind of conversations we're having with them and reviewing their cleanup plans to make sure they're going to comply with our standards. They have a priority list like all federal agencies. Over half of our contaminated sites are on federal land. So we spend, that's why we have $8 million of federal resources to work with them to address those important sites.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. That's Senator Giesel.
Yes, just Ms. Ryan, small point but significant. In Senate Resources last year, we coined the phrase travesty wells versus legacy wells. Mm-hmm. They're not a wonderful legacy. They're a travesty. Thank you.
I need to be on resources.
Thank you for that, Senator Giesel.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just looked at the date here, March 24th. I think this is the sad anniversary of the Exxon Valdez hitting Bly Reef and the impact on not just Prince William Sound but the entire state. So I guess it's coincidental or apropos or both that we're here today. I was a young member of the House of Representatives and lived through that time and still have a little remnant of the Exxon Valdez, some of the oil globules, in a little container on my desk. It was a traumatic time for the entire state, and it was hand-to-hand political combat around here in the trauma of the tragedy there in Prince William Sound. And the big issues were, and I won't dwell on this, but one of them was a modest adjustment in the economic limit factor, the tax regime. But the other big thing that affects our discussion today was the nickel a barrel. And the oil industry lobbyists and the oil executives basically said that's why we have insurance to deal with this. And we'll probably staff up a little better after this situation is dealt with. But they didn't want to deal with the nickel a barrel and fought very hard against that. But public opinion was on the side of having a spill prevention and response fund. And so many years later, we've tried to deal with this in finance subcommittees, as you'll remember, over the years. I credit the sponsor in this body and in the other body for broadening the tax base. That's apparently what needs to happen because previous efforts were sort of squelched by the big three and their representatives here. And they made a reasonable argument that we needed to broaden the tax base for people that also are responsible for some of these spills. So I'm glad we're here today trying to replenish this fund. It needs to happen. It's long overdue. So thank you for the part that you're playing in this, and let's just keep in mind why we're here, what's gone before, and the lessons learned from that tragic day years ago on March 24th. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Ellis. Thank you very much for presenting the administration and the position on this. Now I will be opening public testimony on the legislation. And I have two individuals signed up here in Juneau, Douglas Mertz with the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council. Please come forward and let us know your position on the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Douglas Mertz. I represent the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council, which was created in the wake of the Exxon Valdez to deal with oil spill prevention and response, and has become one of the leading experts in the world in this area. Personally, I worked as an oil spill expert for the Attorney General's office for many of those early years, including the Exxon Valdez era. Specializing in not only oil spill response, but in the legislative response to what happened 26 years ago, including representing the administration on the working group of affected parties that came up with the strategy that was eventually implemented in statute, the statute that exists now, the one that puts all of the burden on the crude industry. Our position on this is that it has to be done. It's essential to become a shortfall in funding what is a necessary function. The two big lessons we learned from the Exxon Valdez, there were two of them, One, most oil spills, most spilled oil is not recovered, so prevention is the absolute critical and most important step. And second, if you don't recover it, contain it, and recover it within the first 72 hours, then forget it. You're not going to recover much at all. This has been proved time and again in spill after spill. So the necessity is to have a robust system in place to prevent spills and then to respond immediately in force when they happen. When the group of stakeholders back 25 years ago discussed how a long-term financing system for spill matters, what it should look like, we went through all the scenarios of where the burden should be, what the economic effect would be. We had economists telling us it doesn't matter. We had various people with various opinions. In the end, we threw up our hands and said, we believe we have the votes to pass it in this fashion, putting the burden entirely on the crude industry. You recall that at that time, the crude industry was not held in the highest esteem by the public, and they were not very effective at defending themselves at that time. And we figured, okay, we'll pass it in that form, and if it needs fixing later, we'll fix it later. So 25 years ago, we're finally doing that. It makes sense to spread the burden to the refined industry since refined products are such a big part of the problem. Therefore, we support that. The other side of what's happening with this bar division, we've got the prevention side, which is funded by these mechanisms, the surcharges, but we've also got the response side, which is funded by another surcharge that creates a $50 million fund. Unfortunately, $50 million in 1991 is the equivalent of about $32 or $33 million in today's dollars, just by the effects of inflation. So we are in a less capable position now to respond to major spills than we were 25 years ago. And it's only going to get worse over time as long as that $50 million is not inflation adjusted. So we recommend a simple adjustment on the response side that either puts an inflation factor in or raises the $50 million to something like $70 million, making it roughly the equivalent of what the legislature created back in 90 and 91. That is the biggest single thing we find lacking here. But as far as what is here and what it will do for the prevention side, it's a good bill, a necessary bill, and we support it wholeheartedly.
Thank you, Mr. Mertz. I appreciate you coming forward with that.
Ask a question.
Senator Meyer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your testimony. You brought up an interesting point. So that $50 million that's sitting in that fund, is that drawing interest or what?
I believe it is.
Okay, and then?
And the interest goes over to the other side, to the prevention side.
Okay, so maybe we could plow that back into the principal and build it that way?
It could be, of course. It's a zero-sum game. Then you're losing money from the prevention side.
Gotcha. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kara Moriarty. And then after Kara, Aves Thompson, I see you're online, and we'll be going to you after Ms. Moriarty.
Good afternoon, Chair Costello and members of the Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, my name is Kara Moriarty, and I'm the President and CEO of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, commonly referred to as AOGA. AOGA is the professional trade association whose mission is to foster the long-term viability of the oil and gas industry for the benefit of all Alaskans. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 86, the bill that's before you today, and commend the sponsor and his staff and those in DEC and the Department of Revenue. We were not involved in crafting the bill. I just want to make that clear. But we did have a lot of communication, a lot of questions, and been in frequent conversations with the commissioner and the director, Ryan, on this bill and issues that I'll talk about in my testimony. AOGA represents the majority of oil and gas producers, explorers, refiners, transporters, and marketers of oil and gas in the state. And just bear with me if you won't mind. I want to list off our current members because it's important, because this is a tax matter. I needed unanimous consent before I could come before you today, and that meant my testimony had to be approved by Alyeska, Pipeline Service Company, Apache, BP, Kalis Energy, Chevron, Eni Petroleum, ExxonMobil, Hillcorp, Petrostar, Repsol, Shell, Statoil, Tesoro, and XTO. So as you can see, both the producers and the refineries in the state of Alaska. As a bit of history, Senator Michikee mentioned this, but Alaska has had some sort of oil spill cleanup fund in place since 1976. When the state created it was then called the Coastal Protection Fund during the construction of TAPS. Over time, the fund morphed into the Oil Spill Mitigation Account and then the Oil Spill Response Account, then in 1986 into what it is known today in statute as the Oil and Hazardous Substance Prevention and Release Response Fund. The name just gets longer, apparently. Or what it's currently referred to as the 470 Fund. And the reason it's called the 470 Fund is because that was the number of the bill at the time. So we all refer to it in the industry as the 470 Fund. In addition to the hundreds of millions of dollars invested each year by the industry in Alaska to prevent, prepare, and respond to the release of hazardous substances, AOGA has long supported fair and equitable efforts to ensure the state of Alaska is also financially prepared. To date, as has been mentioned, the state has collected a surcharge only on our industry to pay for the 470 Fund. If an incident occurs, as Director Ryan mentioned, the oil and gas industry also repays costs associated with the response, as do some other industries. Still, the oil and gas industry is the only industry that has been assessed a specific surcharge or tax for the purposes of this fund. And to date, I think it's important to note that over the last 25, 26 years, the oil and gas industry has contributed more than $350 million through this surcharge for the 470 Fund. We have been engaged in the policy decisions surrounding this fund since its inception, and in 1984, AOGA did support the legislation that split the surcharge into the two separate accounts, one for response and one for prevention, and we didn't oppose the modification to the surcharge in 2005 because the total taxable amount remained at 5 cents per barrel. Despite the stated purpose of cleaning up and preventing spills, previous administrations and legislatures allowed for the fund to be used for non-spill projects such as campgrounds, state airports, tank farm remediation, privately owned greenhouses, and new ferries, just to name a few. I think DEC and the legislature should be commended because it appears those types of expenditures are no longer being appropriated from the fund, but the corpus of the fund may have been unnecessarily reduced during those years when these types of appropriations were authorized. As has been mentioned, although oil and gas production currently accounts for 100% of the surcharge, I think the annual report that DEC has on the table, oil and gas production, exploration altogether amount to around 29% of the total spill volume. It is important to note, as I've mentioned, the oil and gas industry does invest hundreds of millions of dollars every year to have a robust response capability. We would agree with the previous person who testified from Prince William Sound that the key is prevention, and we spend a lot of money doing just that. We are required by federal and state regulations to have contingency plans in place, which are not a simple, easy document. We have spill response equipment available, and we exercise, do drills, and plan and have that equipment properly prepared. In addition, the companies not only support organizations like the gentleman before you from the Prince William Sound Advisory Council, but we also have not-for-profit response cooperatives in Cook Inlet, and on the North Slope and in Prince William Sound. AOGA endorses the same position that the oil and gas transition team for the current administration adopted just this last November, which advocated for the state to utilize other revenue sources before increasing the surcharge on the oil and gas industry. Senate Bill 86 does broaden the contributing efforts of others that use the fund services. Additionally, AOGA advocates for the department to continue to identify efficiencies. And to that end, we will continue to work with DEC and identify suggestions for their consideration, and we'll work with the state to further identify these reductions without, and I think this is important, without diminishing the state's strong oversight and regulation of the industry. We also encourage the state to find those other policies to assist the state in recovering costs from other users, because to date they are only recovering about 30%, and that is another conversation for another day. So in closing, AOGA is not opposed to Senate Bill 86. It does broaden the contribution of others that use the fund services without having an overly adverse impact on our member companies. So with that, that concludes my testimony, Madam Chair. I'm happy to answer any questions that you and the committee may have.
Any questions? Thank you very much, Ms. Moriarty.
You're welcome. Thank you for the history of that, too. That's, I think, always good to know. Aves Thompson, you are in Anchorage at the LIO or online. I'd like to invite you to provide testimony on behalf of the Alaska Trucking Association.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Aves Thompson, Executive Director of the Alaska Trucking Association. The Alaska Trucking Association is a statewide organization representing the interests of our nearly 200 member companies from Barrow to Ketchikan. Freight movement is an essential element of our economy and impacts all of us each and every day. The simple truth is that if you got it, truck brought it. Senate Bill 86 imposes an across-the-board refined fuel surcharge in the amount of 8-tenths of a cent. Senate Bill 86 changes the definition of motor fuel tax from a highway tax to all fuels and seems to make no distinction between off-highway, on-highway, aviation, water, power generation, home heating, or any other purposes, for the purposes of this surcharge. The transportation, air, water, truck, each have a different tax rate, and the financial impact on each of these modes is different. The trucking industry can accept this 10% increase on our mode of transportation, to demonstrate our willingness to do our part to help keep the spill prevention, recovery, and cleanup efforts alive. While it is a requirement for fuel haulers to carry from $1 million to $5 million of liability insurance, there are rare times when that is not enough, the recovery and cleanup fund comes into play. This surcharge helps spread the cost of maintaining the fund among a broader base of users than just the oil producers who currently pay a nickel a barrel fee. ATA supports this fuel tax increase because it's to be used for a specific stated purpose and not just absorbed into the general fund. I'm hopeful that our support delivers the message that they're willing to share in the cost along with everyone else. And again, just to be clear, I'm speaking for the trucking mode of transportation only and not the other modes. Thank you for your attention, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Are there any questions of committee members? Seeing none, thank you very much. Is there anyone else in Juneau who would like to testify on this legislation? Okay. Is there anyone online who would like to testify on this legislation? Okay. With that, I will close public testimony. And I want to ask the committee, are there any questions that you have for the bill sponsor or the administration since they're here? Okay. Seeing none. So the intent then is to bring this Senate Bill 86 back in the form of a committee substitute that addresses some of the technical changes that we've identified earlier with sponsor that are needed, along with the complete fiscal note package. So there'll be two fiscal notes, and then we will hopefully move the bill out from committee at that next hearing. So I wanted to say thank you for everyone who was here to testify and for your efforts.
also to the sponsor for bringing this important legislation forward. And with that, it is 2:35, and the meeting is adjourned.